Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
This is Michael Medved, and on my radio show, I'm generally concerned with what is timely, but every once in a while, we get to focus on the timeless. And when you're talking about the timeless, I immediately think of our trips to Israel. We've taken more than a dozen trips to Israel with listeners, with interested parties, many people who are going to Israel for the first time. And for the first time in 4 years, we're doing it again with Discovery Institute. Check out this remarkable opportunity, the Israel Tour at discovery.org/Israel2019. It's going to be happening in the fall of 2019, late summer, early fall. And we're going to be going with George Gilder about technology, with Stephen Meyer about science, and myself on the history and country and culture of Israel. This is going to be a remarkable experience. Please join us.
Hello, I'm David Klinghoffer, editor of the Center for Science and Culture's daily news source, Evolution News. What we have to offer on today's episode is pretty remarkable. Our colleague, Stephen Meyer, was on Dennis Prager's radio show recently to discuss a volume Steve co-edited, Theistic Evolution, A Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique. On the show, Dennis describes how Dr. Meyer turned him around on the question of evolution. Prager has generously allowed us to air the conversation at ID the Future. Here's part one of what they had to say.
Hi, everybody. Dennis Prager here. Every Tuesday, the third hour of my show is called the Ultimate Issues Hour. As many of you know, I have a great analogy for why this is significant. A map will give you a perfectly accurate statement of where you are. But if you don't know where you want to go, a map is useless. I think a lot of people have maps, but no destinations. So this hour is, in effect, the destination hour. What are the big issues? The big issues have always preoccupied me. In high school, I remember writing an essay on the moral necessity of the afterlife. Not what most of my friends were thinking about. On the other hand, I do want you to know, folks, I went to hockey games every week. I did lead a normal life, semi-normal. Anyway, it's the Ultimate Issues Hour. I'm Dennis Prager, and I have a truly terrific guest. Man, I have tremendous respect for Stephen Meyer, director of the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. Would you tell people, I think it's important given that we're going to talk about science and faith, so tell people, don't be humble, some of your credentials in that arena.
Sure. I, as you mentioned, direct this network of scientists run out of the Discovery Institute in Seattle. My PhD is in the philosophy of science from the University of Cambridge in England. Prior to that, I worked as a geophysicist and did a double physics, geology, or science degree in, as an undergraduate. And I've written a couple books, one Signature in the Cell on the question of the origin of the first life, and the second one called Darwin's Doubt, which is a question of, about the origin of the first animals, which appear very abruptly in the fossil record in contradiction to Darwin's own expectations of a very gradual origin for animal life.
So your life has been immersed in science. By the way, just I've never asked you this in all our time, both privately and on radio and public. What does the philosophy of science mean?
It's the discipline that addresses scientific questions that are right at the margin of science and philosophy. Things about the nature and basis of human knowledge, what's called in philosophy epistemology, how we know what we know, but also questions about the consciousness, the origin of the universe, the origin of life. And these are the topics that have always really fascinated me. How did we get here? How did life get here? There's a huge scientific dimension to these questions, but they also have incorrigibly philosophical implications. And so
right.
I've always been attracted right at that boundary between the two. And you have to learn a lot of science to be any good in it, and you have to be thinking philosophically to make any sense of it.
It's a great combination. Did you enjoy your time at Cambridge?
Immensely.
Really?
Yeah. If you have to do something as grueling as a PhD, it's nice to do it in some place like Cambridge or Oxford, where there are a lot of cultural compensations and wonderful people.
And the weather helps.
The weather's awful, but I'm right. from Seattle, so I was
already
inoculated.
Right. That's right. I never thought of that. His latest book, which he edited, is a collection of essays, and don't let the title in any way intimidate you, Theistic Evolution, a Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique. In other words, theistic evolution is the attempt of many and very good-willed people to reconcile God and evolution. And this is a series of essays critical
of that position.
Right,
yeah.
Of that position. So let me get to that. The book is up at DennisPrager.com. And obviously, any of you interested in theology or science will find this immensely interesting. So I mentioned to you right before we went on the air that until I met you, to be honest, my view was I didn't really care about evolution. It didn't bother me if it was true, and it didn't bother me if it wasn't true. I believed in God as the creator of the heavens and the earth, the God of Genesis 1. And if God used evolution, what do I care? It's all a miracle anyway. So that in a nutshell. Then I've read you and talked to you. And my wife, frankly, who knows a fair amount, as you know, about evolution, and it has become less and less tenable, not for religious reasons, but for scientific reasons, to endorse the evolution as it is generally taught. So before we get to God and evolution, I know this is ridiculous in the time that I'm going to give you, but in a couple of minutes, can you summarize evolution and why it's not...
Why we might be skeptical about it.
Well, and yeah. not only we...
Yeah.
Right, okay. But scientists.
Right.
This is what you opened my mind to. Yeah. Scientists are having trouble with evolution.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
So, quick... Three definitions of the term evolution for orientation. The first is simply change over time. Nobody challenges that there has been change over time, or the kind of small-scale variation we see in Galapagos finch beaks or peppered moths or bacteria that acquire antibiotic resistance. That's sometimes called microevolution. Second definition of evolution is the idea of universal common descent and the idea that all organisms are connected by common ancestry back to one or very few simple forms, such that the best picture of the history of life is like a giant branching tree. That was part of Darwin's argument in The Origin. And the third and most controversial meaning of evolution is the idea that there's an unguided, undirected mechanism, namely natural selection acting on random mutations, that can produce all the new forms of life that have emerged in the history of life, that produces all the change over time, and that mechanism is also responsible for the appearance of design that biological systems manifest, that even leading evolutionary biologists acknowledge. So those are three key definitions. The first is innocuous. Nobody doubts it. The second is somewhat controversial. The third is
deeply controversial. Where do you stand on the second, on the tree?
I'm skeptical about the universal common descent. There's a lot of discontinuity in the fossil record and in the genomic patterns that we're now observing. But the key issue, and the one that leading evolutionary biologists themselves are now questioning, is the idea that the mutation selection mechanism has genuine creative power, the ability to generate fundamentally new forms of life. So what you'll hear a lot of evolutionary biologists quoting now, an aphorism, is that mutation and selection explains the survival but not the arrival of the fittest. It explains the small-scale variations but not the major innovations. And in virtue of that, 2 years ago this time, I was at a conference of the Royal Society in Britain, the oldest and arguably most august scientific body in the world. They called a conference to assess modern neo-Darwinism, and specifically to call for a new theory of evolution. Many of the evolutionary biologists there were deeply unhappy with the idea that mutation and selection has creative power. The opening talk at the conference by Gerd Müller, a leading Austrian evolutionary biologist, enumerated several key, what he called explanatory deficits of the modern version of Darwin's theory, neo-Darwinism. A number of the deficits that he enumerated were things that I had written on at length in my own book, Darwin's Doubt.
This is stunning. The Royal Society, what is the full name?
The Royal Society of London. It was started by, you know, Robert Boyle. Newton was one of its first presidents.
Just reading about them yesterday. Yeah. Okay. So that's incredible. They had a conference on the weaknesses of the traditional Darwinian explanation?
Where most, if not all, of the talks were exploring some new mechanisms that could supplement, complement, replace the standard mutation selection mechanism. The odd thing about the conference, however, was that there were a group of what they call themselves third way people. They don't want to associate with those of us who are supportive of intelligent design, and that is a growing number of scientists, by the way. But they reject standard neo-Darwinism, so they're looking for another approach. They have one group of those scientists is known as the Altenburg 16, and one of the scientists who was involved in that, who helped call the conference, declared at the end of this Royal Society conference that it was interesting, but it was characterized by a lack of momentousness. In other words, they did a good job of critiquing the neo-Darwinian mechanism, but nothing really was offered to solve this problem.
Yeah, because they've rejected out of hand intelligent design.
Any design, guidance, any
right.
mind or purpose in the process by which life arises.
So where those flaws might be, and then the issue of reconciling, if possible, God and this and evolution. My guest is Dr. Stephen Meyer, director of the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. He has now edited Theistic Evolution, A Critique. All right, everybody. My guest on this Ultimate Issues Hour, third hour every Tuesday, the Ultimate Issues Hour is Dr. Stephen Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R. The Discovery Institute is one of my favorite places. These are a bunch of scientists who have the audacity to believe that there is actually a divine hand, a creator involved in the universe, which is, to me, the single most rational position one can have. The notion that intelligence comes from non-intelligence is not intelligent. That was a new one.
That's good.
Yeah, I like that. I think we need a microphone here, and you're not. I think we got a. My guest is Dr. Stephen Meyer, and his latest book he is editor of is a collection of essays, "Theistic Evolution: A Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique of the Notion." That God is behind evolution, and this is a critique of that. So let's go to evolution itself. I periodically have you on. As far as I'm concerned, I could have you on every day. And I mean it. I adore you. I adore your work. And you have the requisite scientific background to answer these issues. This that you just reported that the Royal Society in London would have a conference on, and tell me if my summary is fair, is it tenable to continue to believe in the Darwinian notion of
creative power of mutation and natural selection? This was the key proposition
under
consideration.
So what you have led me to understand, and I was agnostic on evolution much of my life. I didn't really care. I believe in God as the creator, and the methodology did not interest me. But I don't want to believe in or even be agnostic about something that just isn't upheld by scientists. So what's the biggest weakness?
The biggest weakness, I think, has to do with the problem of the origin of form, new innovation of fundamentally new forms of life. But that requires a prior innovation, and that is innovation of information, the creation of information. Since Watson and Crick in 1953, we have understood that information in a digital form inscribed along the spine of the DNA molecule is essentially running the show at the cellular level in biology. If you want to build a new form of animal life, you've got to have new tissues and cell types, but new cell types require new dedicated proteins to service them. And proteins are constructed on the basis of the information, a four-character code that is stored in the DNA molecule. So new form requires new information. And as we've understood more about the digital nature of the information, it really isn't – it's alphabetic or typographic or digital in character. And we understand that by reference to, say, our own experience with computer code. The idea that you could randomly start to change very specific arrangements of characters that are designed to construct one thing and turn them into another message that will construct another completely different thing is implausible. If you take a section of computer code and start randomly changing the zeros and ones, you're not going to produce a new program or operating system. You're going to introduce glitches and bugs, and you'll ultimately destroy the function of the original sequence that you had. And the genetic sequence is similarly vulnerable to that kind of random mutational change. And yet, the neo-Darwinians invoke random mutation as the agent of innovation, the agent of creation, when in fact it's either an agent of destruction or it can introduce very minor preservable changes that might slightly tweak or optimize an
existing
form. All
right, so when I hear you say this, I'm thinking of all the preeminent scientists of the last 100 years who have believed what you now say is not tenable. What does that say? If you're right, what does that say about scientists?
That science, like every other form of human endeavor, can be subject to groupthink, or to or it can be influenced by prior ideological commitments. In particular, in the debate about biological origins, there is a prior commitment to a materialistic approach to the question. It's codified in a principle known as methodological naturalism. And it says that if you're going to be a true scientist, you have to limit yourself to strictly materialistic explanations for everything, not just how nature ordinarily operates, which would be quite sensible, but where nature itself came from. And that principle then precludes the possibility of precludes consideration of a designing intelligence. And yet, what have we discovered at the foundation of life? We've discovered digital code. Bill Gates, our local hero in the Seattle area, says that DNA is like a software program, only much more complex than any we've ever devised. Well, where does software come from? It comes from a mind. We have all sorts of indications of intelligent activity at the foundation of life. We've got digital code. We have a complex information processing system. We have nanotechnology, miniature machines that are mind-blowing in their integrated complexity. We've got circuitry controlling the expression of genetic information. And no persuasive Darwinian explanation has been offered for any of this type of complexity, the integrated or organizational complexity at the microscopic level.
So it's basically all some aberration was born, and it prospered because it was better than the previous.
A plausible theory in the 19th century was formulated by Darwin before we knew about the complexity of life at the microscopic and molecular level. In the wake of that theory, a principle of reasoning was codified among scientists, namely that we must limit ourselves to materialistic explanations of the kind that Darwin promulgated. And then as the evidence from the 1950s, 60s, and right to the present has begun to stack up, evidence that would in any other realm of experience point to a designing intelligence, the principle of methodological naturalism has prevented many scientists from considering the obvious implication.
Right. Okay, I'm totally on board. The question that you have taught me to ask is, are even the people who only believe in a naturalist or a material explanation, are they starting to question traditional?
They are.
All right, hold on. Yeah. That's what we'll get the answer to.
That was part one of Dennis Prager and Stephen Meyer on The Dennis Prager Show, courtesy of Dennis's subscription service, Pragertopia. We'll air part two here at ID the Future soon. To find more of Dennis Prager's excellent material, audio, video, and articles, go to DennisPrager.com. For ID the Future, this is David Klinghoffer. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.